Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, November the 9th, 2012. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm here today with my guest co-host, Jackie. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Alyssa is away today. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. For our first segment today, in honor of Remembrance Day, which is this Sunday, November 11th, I'll be presenting a segment entitled Animals in the Time of War, which was actually presented years ago by our past Animal Voices host, Carl Oskin, and definitely deserves attention again during this poignant part of the year when we stop to think about and recognize all those who have given up their lives for us in the time of war. Non-human animals have played a part in the sacrifice as well during times of war, and so I will be talking about some of the roles that animals have and still do carry out in war, but of course without their voluntariness to do so. There's a really beautiful music video that I posted up on our website to depict some of these images of animals in war. Please check it out at animalvoices.org. And for our feature interview today, we have a bit of a crossover in shows for you. Alex Smith from the fantastic environmental show Radio EcoShock, which airs after us, shares his time and energy with Animal Voices as we will present an interview by Alex with Daniel Imhoff. Daniel Imhoff is a researcher, author, and independent publisher who has concentrated for nearly 20 years on issues related to farming, the environment, and design. He is the author of numerous articles and essays, plus the editor of the book CAFO, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories, and its companion book, The CAFO Reader. CAFOs are, of course, concentrated animal feeding operations, otherwise known as factory farms. And he will speak with Alex on the show on this topic, one of the most pressing issues of our time. I want to thank all of our listeners and supporters who donated to our recent fall member drive here at Co-op Radio, and wanted to let our Animal Voices donors know that we should have all the names of all of our donors sent in to us by next week. So you can expect us to do our draw next week for five fabulous prizes that we offered during the fundraising drive. So please do stay tuned for that. I also wanted to mention that I was actually interviewed yesterday. I was the one being interviewed for a radio show called The Sexy Vegan Radio Show, which airs live on Sundays at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time via the internet at party934.com. So if you want to hear a bit of my story of veganism there, I encourage you to tune into that. And I also do talk about the Animal Voices show on that interview. You can also listen to it as a podcast later on at party934.com. And now, last week was my birthday week, but it was your birthday week too, Jackie.
Yeah, it was on Saturday.
Yeah, and mine was on Friday, and we only discovered that a few days ago. So happy belated birthday to you.
Yeah, you too.
I know that I certainly like to celebrate special occasions, i.e. my birthday, with food, and that's exactly what I did last week. Last Thursday evening, my wonderful friend Lisa, who took me out for a delicious pre-birthday dinner at Indigo Cafe, which is an all-raw restaurant here in Vancouver, one of my favorites, and we've talked about it on the show before, so I won't go too much into it now, but everything, as usual, was delicious. I just wanted to make a special mention of Lavenna's carrot curry soup, which is, it's just to die for, as well as the kelp noodle salad, which has a really great Asian rice vinegar tang to it. Those are the two dishes that I'm still thinking about today, so I'm actually going to go back there today.
Yeah, after, sounds delicious.
After the show, because for my lunch / dinner, because I need to. Have you been to Indigo?
I have, yeah. It's been a while, but I went there once, yeah.
Oh, you got to go more than once. It's wonderful, and luckily it's sort of in my neighborhood, so I do try to remember to pass by whenever I can. It's right by the Choices store, too, so you can make it a double trip and go do some grocery shopping as well. So for my official dinner, my friend Cameron, another wonderful friend, obliged me by taking me out to one of Vancouver's newest vegetarian restaurants, which I've really been wanting trying to try ever since it opened, and that was the Acorn Restaurant. Alyssa and Tim went there to the Acorn months ago when it first opened, and they did an official review of it here on the show, so I won't go into it too much today, except to say that I thought it was all really good. Have you been to the Acorn?
I actually haven't. I've been wanting to try that place, but I haven't got the opportunity to go out there
yet. So you didn't choose that one for your birthday dinner, so we'll get to that in a bit. So that's the one I chose for my birthday dinner, and the one that you went to is totally next on my list. So the Acorn, yeah, so it's not a vegan restaurant, it's vegetarian. Their menu is mostly dairy-based, so the vegan options are limited, but what we had, I mean, there's certainly enough vegan choices on there to totally satisfy you. Mostly what we had was actually raw vegan, so it's nice to know that there's choices there too, options for raw. We started out with a raw beet ravioli, which is really good. I don't know if you've had the raw beet ravioli at Organic Lives, very similar. So they actually shave beets and then have like a cashew cheese in the middle. So
I love beets.
Yeah, so the beet slices are actually like the pasta ravioli part. We also shared a raw lasagna. I was really looking forward to this because if people were listening to the show months ago, I made a raw lasagna from Mimi Kirk's book, Live Raw, and it was just amazing. I was sort of expected to be really impressed, like I was with my own lasagna a few months ago, but it wasn't as good, I have to say. It wasn't as good. And then we also had some other food. The desserts were really delicious, a chocolate peanut terrine and a coconut lemongrass panna cotta, but it was also really pricey. The desserts are about $9 to $11, and the entrees are in the $20 range. So it's definitely not a place I think that the average person can go to just for, you know, a regular meal. I'm thinking it's more like, for me, like a once a year thing. So,
special occasions.
Yeah, definitely special occasions. So yeah, and I also made a wonderful, delicious peanut butter bomb birthday cake last week, which unfortunately you missed out on. I was here by myself last week on my birthday, so I wasn't able to bring anyone any cake, but it's all gone now. Anyways, that is how I celebrated my birthday. And where did you go to celebrate your birthday?
Well, on my birthday, my girlfriend actually took me out to a really nice dinner at Vancouver's actual newest vegetarian place, which is Heirloom Restaurant.
Just opened October 10th.
Yeah, it did. It just opened October 10th. And they're actually open daily. Just recently, I think November 1st, they started serving brunch from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Right.
And they have dinner from 5 p.m. to midnight.
And that's 7 days a week, I believe,
that is 7 days a week, yeah. And they offer a wide selection of fresh vegetable-based dishes. So it's not fully vegan, but they had enough vegan options, and they were more than happy to accommodate and modify dishes. So that was wonderful. Yeah. So when I walked in there, they had two separate seating areas. They had a lounge section, which was, you know, near the bar. It had higher seating, and it's more just for lounging out. And they had a dining area with some nice white tables and some brighter lighting. So the environment, it was very white and clean, kind of similar to Organic Lives. And okay. It was a little noisy, but it's just due to the fact that the dining area was, you know, very...
Organic Lives is sure noisy.
Exactly.
Making all the smoothies.
I think it was just noisy because everyone was having such a good time. And the fact that it's busy is really good, especially considering...
And, you know, the Acorn was super busy. We had to wait about an hour to get seated. I was really actually impressed. I wasn't upset. I was like, I said to the waitress, that's awesome that you're
so
busy.
It's really good.
It's awesome that we have to wait an hour.
Especially how new they are and being that busy.
They don't
hard.
Take reservations, but they said on their Facebook that they promise to feed you if you have to stand in line, so that's a good
that's always a positive
win-win.
You're not going to leave hungry. So the menu was also a little smaller at Heirloom than many other vegetarian restaurants like Nam, but however, just by looking over the items listed, you can see that everything is very seasonal, fresh, organic, and mostly local, which is quite important to me, because you know, carbon footprint as well. And although not, like I said, not all menu items were vegan, they did have a lot of raw options, and they did have enough vegan options, and they were happy to modify that, which I thought was, you know, very nice of them, because a lot of places, you know, are not so accommodating.
You would hope they would be, because,
would
you know, vegan's so similar to vegetarian.
Yeah.
That's going to be a large part of the clientele as well.
And they did have some gluten-free options around as well, so which is always good to see, because there are people that have sensitivities. And so I ordered the vegan stew, which was delicious autumn stew with squash, white beans, quinoa, and cauliflower. So the squash base was really nice, smooth texture with larger pieces of squash mixed in with the other veggies. And it was atop a pile of pureed cauliflower. And my girlfriend ordered the raw cauliflower risotto. So obviously we both love cauliflower.
Yeah.
which replaced the rice of
and
a
it's
typical...
good for you.
It is very good. So it replaced the rice of a typical risotto with pureed cauliflower and included hemp seeds, walnut cheese, and various herbs and greenery. And I, of course, had to have a taste of her dish, and it was very delicious as well. And for dessert, we shared the pumpkin mousse, which was also very seasonal and delightful and not too sweet. So it's also a little pricier as well, kind of like Oytorn, sorry.
I've heard it described as fine dining in quotes
here.
Yeah,
exactly. It's definitely another and special occasion.
I think we definitely do need places like that in Vancouver. Yeah. I've always been saying that is we need some really sort of higher end, really nice places that you can go for a special occasion. And now I guess we have a couple of them.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it was about $16 for... About 15 to 16 for the mains.
For the entrees? So
yeah,
that's
exactly.
actually cheaper than the acorn. How much were the desserts about?
The desserts were around $10, $11.
Okay, so that's the same.
Yeah, so it's around the same. But like I said, you know, the food is quality over quantity, and you're paying a
local.
Bit more for that, but you know, it's worth it in the end, I think.
I totally don't mind giving my money to establishments in which they really take care of their food and where it's all you can get all vegan. That's definitely something to be treasured in this city.
Exactly. We don't have enough options, so it's always good when some new ones come about. So Heirloom Vegetarian Restaurant is located at 1509 West 12th, that's 12th and Granville in Vancouver, and their Facebook page is under Heirloom Vegetarian or heirloomrestaurant.ca, so please look them up. They are a fabulous place, and it's always good to support local new vegetarian restaurants.
Thursdays, 4 p.m., a parenting show in the age of transparency. We reflect on current affairs, culture, activism, and pepper the hour with poignant songs that help explain the world. Join us every Thursday with your family on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
It takes a village. It takes a village to raise. It takes a village to raise a child.
So you are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM, CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And I have a few events to list off for you guys now. So coming up pretty quickly, Tuesday, November 13th from 6 to 9 p.m. is Liberation BC's Volunteer Night. This night will be spent making signs and banners in preparation for leafletting at Paul McCartney's upcoming concert. As always, there'll be lots of delicious snacks and lots of fun. And also, in relation to this, at Paul McCartney's concert on November 25th, Liberation BC needs some volunteers to do some outreach with his fans. It will involve handing out vegan outreach leaflets to a crowd of 52,000 at BC Place. All details will be announced on their Facebook page or their website, liberationbc.org.
I think that's a great idea and great venue to do it at. And I think Alyssa's going to be going to that. Maybe she can report back from us because Paul McCartney has been a proponent for the animals for many decades.
Oh, yeah.
So definitely a place to get people's attention.
Exactly. A good representation of his values. And there's also a new and exciting animal and vegan-related show that's based out of California. It's called Animal Issues with Dr. Armeti May.
That's right.
And that's airing Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. online at adrenalineradio.com. So please check her out.
I listened to the first show this week. I know Armeti May, actually. She's a vegan vet who lives in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Nice person, really great AR activist. And the first show that she did was good.
Yeah,
really
I actually good. Listened to her show as well, and it was cool. It was really, really good. And it's nice to know that people in the medical community as well have animal rights issues at heart. And also in California, there'll be an exciting event. It's Cease Animal Torture presents Animal Liberation Forum 2012. Mm-hmm. So there will be musical acts, a vegan potluck, tons of events and film screenings. I so wish I could go to this.
This is the Animal Liberation Forum, is
exactly,
that right? Yeah,
exactly.
Right. So we had them on the show about like 3 or 4 weeks ago. So if people are interested in finding out more, and we actually did a feature interview, just check on our Facebook or on our website, animalvoices.org, and just look up Animal Liberation Forum. It's actually not too far back there. So
It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, I have to say. So this will take place on November 16th, 17th, and 18th at California State University. All right. And another one is Fur Free Friday at Winners.
Mm-hmm. And so that's in Vancouver.
Right? That is in Vancouver. So with 213 stores Canada-wide, most Canadians have no idea that Winners is one of the largest, if not the largest, retailer of cheap, cruel fur-trimmed products in the country.
You don't think about that when you think
you
about
don't.
Winners. You think about good deals.
Yeah, cheap clothing.
That
unfortunately,
cheap is the is the key word there.
Exactly.
And I don't think they really have. I can't. From what I know, is I'm not sure if they really have any ethical standards when it comes to their purchasing policy, because they just seem to get clothes from wherever, right?
They get whatever
various sources,
whatever people want, exactly,
or and whatever that, people have to sell to, because
exactly.
they're buying it from from places that can't sell.
Yeah. So, I mean, the problem is that many of these fur trimmed garments are labeled as faux fur. So many people buying the items,
right.
you know, they're buying it unknowingly. And so this protest demonstration will take place at 798 Granville Street Winners from 1 to 3 p.m. And that is on November 23rd, I believe. And also, please keep in mind, Winners is not the only offenders of unlabeled fur-trimmed items. Many items that you may find while shopping elsewhere that are labeled as to have faux fur trim are indeed made from cat and dog fur in fur farms. Because, unfortunately, the Canadian Textile and Labeling Act does not require the labeling of animal pelts or hides, so please carefully read your clothing labels. If it does not specifically say what materials the faux fur is made from, please don't buy it. And to find out any more on this topic, please go to furbeardefenders.com. And also we do have the Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp, which will be coming up in February of this year. So it's February 23rd and 24th, 2013, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the W2 Media Cafe on West Hastings Street. So this is just a great opportunity for Vancouver activists to get together and learn from each other's experience and build a stronger community of animal advocates.
And I, just as a heads up, I will actually be starting a Facebook group online
for
anyone, for animal advocacy camp, for people just to connect with each other before and after the event, because we're having it every year now, right? So I thought it would be a good idea if we sort of had like this online forum where we can just connect with each other and keeping communication with each other. Have you ever been to one of the animal advocacy camps?
I haven't, but I really want to go this year. I'm going to try to go.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So thanks so much for that, Jackie.
Yeah, no problem. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to us to list on your show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And right now I wanted to take a moment to talk about Remembrance Day and animals in the time of war. And this is a piece as was presented by Carl Oskin several years ago on the Animal Voices show. Animals do not choose to join a conflict. They do not have a voice in the matter. They do not understand the basic geopolitical reasons why humans fight, nor can they differentiate between humans of different ideological persuasions. Yet they suffer the same destructive fate that many human combatants suffer. Animals have through the ages been used in conflict as beasts of burden, as actors carrying out operations in harm's way, as messengers of death and destruction, as a strategy of war, as a source of funds, as mascots, and finally as experimental subjects. No other animal arguably has played a greater role in the history of warfare as the horse. Horses were first placed into battle sometime between 2000 and 1000 BC. There has also been an incredible variety of combat tasks where animals were and are being put to use in ways that may result in their death. For example, dogs were utilized in Vietnam by U.S. troops to clear Viet Cong tunnels and caves and to sniff out landmines and booby traps. At any given time, there were 4,000 dogs employed in Vietnam for military purposes. All but 200 were left to the Viet Cong, many of whom were tortured. The Viet Cong intensely disliked U.S. scout dogs so much that they often placed bounties on the dogs' heads. The Viet Cong was a political organization and army in South Vietnam and Cambodia that fought the United States and South Vietnamese governments during the Vietnam War. Dogs have also been used in just about every war as sentries, guarding forts, military bases, and individual soldiers. In World War I, dogs were used in and around no man's land to deliver messages and supplies. They were also appropriated to lay copper telephone wire around no man's land for telephone service, with the wire placed on rolls strapped to onto their backs. Many were, of course, shot at. Their history of service received very little gratitude and recognition. To this day, dogs in the U.S. military do not retire. Military working dogs are considered equipment, no different from a shell casing or a rifle. When their use is completed, they are simply terminated. Cats were used in the trenches of World War I to help eradicate the hordes of rats that were plaguing the troops, with thousands of them succumbing to mustard gas and daily shell fire. Dolphins, sea lions, and even whales have been and are still used to spot sea mines by the many navies around the world. In the past, the military have employed dolphins to retrieve sea mines. Dolphins and sea lions have been trained and employed exclusively to spot sea mines. Once the mines have been detected, the animals leave a buoyant tag that is visible to the Navy personnel on ship. Elephants have been employed in battle in great numbers in Africa, Asia, and Europe. Their role was more or less synonymous to that of a modern-day tank. Elephants would plow through towards the enemy, causing mayhem in their ranks. Elephants were quite difficult to disable due to their size and thick skin, which could be afflicted with several wounds and still maintain battle readiness. Pigeons have been used throughout the history of warfare. Information such as the conquest of Gaul by Caesar was relayed to Rome by pigeons, as was the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. Pigeons, as well as parakeets, have been used as warning devices against chemical and biological weapons in several 20th century wars. Pigeons and parakeets are currently being utilized by British troops in the Persian Gulf to warn against possible nerve and chemical agents that might be employed by anti-coalition forces. Monkeys have served in several conflicts in different ways. In the current war in Iraq, Morocco has served the U.S. military 2,000 specially trained monkeys whose sole purpose is to detonate landmines. Whether the U.S. military accepted the offer was unclear. Animals operating in harm's way in combat mostly have one thing in common. Although some of them were chosen because of abilities superior to humans, most were deployed because the duties that they carried out were considered too dangerous for human combatants. Thus, the job fell to them, their lives amounting to less than that of humans. Destruction of animals has been used as a strategy of war for centuries. The logic is to deny your adversary food, clothing, and in some cases, shelter and affordances for a living by large-scale extermination of wild and domesticated animals. The strategy was indispensably exercised by the Russians against Napoleon's troops during their invasion of Russia in 1812. The American government encouraged this tactic as part of their protracted conflict with the many Indian nations that occupied the Great Plains by encouraging mostly private hunters to slaughter millions of buffalo, which the Plains Indians used for food, tools, and material for shelter. In 1874, during the height of slaughter, which included several million buffalo in only a couple of years, Secretary of the Interior Columbus Delano testified before Congress on the large-scale hunting of the buffalo, saying that, "The buffalo is disappearing rapidly, but not faster than I desire. I regard the destruction of such game as Indians subsist upon as facilitating the policy of government of destroying their hunting habits, coercing them on reservations, and compelling them to begin to adopt the habits of civilization." The military joined forces with scientists and corporations to form what is now known as the military-industrial complex, which needed huge supplies of animals to test their outpouring of military hardware. In the U.S. each year, at least 320,000 primates, dogs, pigs, goats, sheep, rabbits, mice, cats, and other animals are burned, infected, shot, blasted, shocked, poisoned, dissected, and maimed by the U.S. Department of Defense. This figure does not include military animal testing carried out by contracted companies in the service of the Department of Defense. Nobel laureate, writer, and Holocaust survivor Isaac Singer noted that while living next door to a slaughterhouse in Chicago, he noticed that the men and women who worked in the slaughterhouse had the same blank expression on their faces entering and leaving work that the German soldiers guarding and running the concentration camps had on their faces during the Holocaust. In an issue of Haaretz, Israel's most respected daily newspaper, it was reported that experiments carried out by the Israeli Defense Forces on animals were so horrific that soldiers forced to conduct the experiments had to seek psychological counseling. The saddest aspect of the subject, however, is our complete obliviousness to the monumental sacrifices of animals in combat. Author Jillie Cooper, in her book Animals in War, commented on this in the most moving way. She says, "Most animals that died in war have no memorial. Sick, wounded, starved, slaughtered, they have perished as though they have never been. The only way that we can repay them is to treat them with more kindness and peace and hope in the future that they are drawn as little as possible into our wars. If we fail to give them at least this much, then perhaps we should at least take the time to study them as social beings, for they could teach us many things if we decided to take a cue from them. Animals do not know greed, racism, sexism, religionism, or any other form of bigotry. I believe that if we decided to follow many of their examples, we might just become a better species for it." Leonardo da Vinci said, "The time will come when men such as I will look on the murder of animals as they look on the murder of men. This Remembrance Day, I implore you to not only remember the fallen humans in the time of war, but to recognize the fallen non-humans as well, none of who had had a choice to risk and sacrifice their lives at the expense of human conflict." We will conclude this segment now with a few minutes of the piece called Hymn for the Fallen by John Williams, originally composed to recognize fallen human soldiers, but it can also certainly be applied to all creatures who have died in war. You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And now I have our headlines for this week. I think the biggest animal-related news story of the past week was last Sunday, a 12-year-old giraffe was found dead inside his barn at the Greater Vancouver Zoo, which is, of course, really sad. Jackie, I know you heard about this as well. I think it's all really been all over the news. So this giraffe's name was Jafari, and apparently there were two other giraffes that also died last year as well. They're relatives. Anyways, this is really a sad thing. Last year, in November 2011, 3-year-old Amarin and 23-year-old Aaliyah, they are also found dead. Now, the Vancouver Humane Society spokesperson, Peter Fricker, we've had him on the show before. He has a lot to say about this. He says that, for one thing, having three giraffes die in 1 year is unacceptable, and he thinks that the zoo needs to be held accountable for these deaths. Right now, a necropsy has been done, but they don't know what the results are, and it's not even known if they're going to be, if the results are going to be made public at all, because apparently it's just not known why the giraffe died. But speculations are that, you know, is North America an appropriate place for a giraffe to be living, or it's in Aldergrove specifically?
And Absolutely not.
Yeah, well, this was asked, is that an appropriate setting for African animals? That was asked to the zoo, and a zoo spokesperson, she said that, well, these animals were born in Canada. They weren't brought from Africa. But I really don't think I'm not an animal expert. I'm not a giraffe expert. But, you know, animals, I think that British Columbia is not suitable for giraffes.
And genetically, they are not designed for our climate. Nope.
Exactly. So you shouldn't be keeping African animals in Western Canada. It's the wrong climate. Giraffes kept at temperatures lower than their natural habitat. They need to have a diet that compensates for the lower temperature. And so apparently, Jafari and his other family members, they were having a specialized diet that included pellets, not the acacia leaves that they're used to eating in the African forest, because we don't have those here, right?
No.
So it is believed that this was definitely a contributing reason to why the giraffe died, and apparently he seemed to be doing fine, and the zoo staff said, oh, he had enough fat on him, to, you know, that he needed to keep himself safe and healthy, but he was just found dead. The zoo spokesperson, she says that she believes that keeping some animals in captivity helps educate. What do you think? You know, I think animals aren't here for us.
No.
They're not here to educate us.
And if people want to educate their children, give them a book, buy them a subscription to a wildlife magazine or something like that. They don't need to see animals behind cages.
Definitely. And anyways, an update to the story is that the BCSPCA is actually doing an investigation as to potential mishandling of the animals there, because the Vancouver Zoo actually has a long history of poor treatment of animals, right? So apparently the SPCA is being hampered because the Greater Vancouver Zoo staff workers refuse to share key information that the SPCA needs to conduct their investigation. The SPCA said the zoo is refusing to share records relating to the animals' care, diet, and necropsy results. And that is just another part to that story there. And I guess we'll hear more in the future about this. One other story is the Vancouver Aquarium has launched a $100 million capital campaign after accepting the largest private donation in its history. That's $12.5 million from Tech Resources Limited. Tech's capital campaign donation will finance the redesign and 47,000 square foot expansion of the aquarium's entrance gallery by May 2014. They also have a lot of other expansion plans. They also started an aquarium that was ready to host a new exhibit of South African penguins in their featured Penguin Point viewing area. And they've already spent $500,000 to showcase penguins. I don't know if you were around at this time, Jackie, but when I was little, there used to be penguins at the...
They used to have a whole zoo there. Yeah.
Well, exactly. But they used to have a penguin exhibit, and saying that in quotes. And, you know, Vancouver really isn't a good enough habitat for penguins that come from Antarctic. Exactly. And that closed in the mid-1990s. So anyways, that is a pretty big thing. And I guess we'll be hearing more about that. You know, that actually the attendance from at the aquarium, it hovers around 900,000 visitors per year. And last year, the aquarium raked in more than $29.4 million in revenue, which was up from $28.5 million generated in 2010. So unfortunately, I would have to say that it looks like there's going to be just even more exploitation for the animals there when it comes to the Vancouver Aquarium.
In the news, at least five big supermarket chains recalled millions of eggs due to salmonella poisoning. The big shock for many of us? All those eggs came from a single Midwest farm. How precarious our food supply is now that farming has morphed into industrial mega machinery. The new word we have to learn, CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. EarthAware publishers have just brought out two new books on the tragedy of industrial animal factories. There is a CAFO reader and a big, big book of companion photos that could frighten you. Here to talk about it is Daniel Imhoff, editor of both.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, you've written books like Food Fight, Farming with the Wild, but this project must have been very tough to document, was it?
Absolutely. I've been a researcher and writer, independent publisher, for about 20 years, and normally my approach is to take a very urgent issue and explain it rather quickly but in a deep context, and then spend most of my time really assessing and featuring solutions to that problem. But CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations, it's for the most part a book that is trying to give something that most people don't have, which is a behind-the-scenes look at industrial animal agriculture, where our meat and our poultry and milk products are increasingly produced, and it is not a pretty picture.
I want to take a second because I had a striking personal reaction to these images taken from our mass food system, and I can only tell it like this. You know, when I was 10, looking through my grandfather's bookshelf, I pulled down a scary book. It was filled with photographs from the Holocaust, the industrial slaughter of human beings. No one had told me about it, and those images never left me. And I had a similar reaction when I got your big book of photos and essays on these animal farms. It was filled with stuff we never see in the mainstream media. A hidden sort of animal holocaust, if you will, and it made me feel sick. How are we going to overcome our aversion, the fact that we don't want to know, the fear and the nausea that we're afraid of, when we confront the realities of massive animal suffering that is happening in our names?
Well, I was thinking that we might have had a kind of a warning page, a cautionary warning right as you open the book that says, warning, this book contains explicit photographs of food production. You know, I don't know how you break down this ethical barrier and this reaction to, this defensive reaction to not want to see how the animals are treated that we depend upon for food. If our pets were treated the same way, we certainly would be very concerned, and we would want to see, and we would want to know, and actually we would probably want to persecute. And so somehow, because this is becoming the increasingly dominant way that we're producing food animals, not just here, but in other parts of the world as well, and because the costs of this food production system are becoming more and more obvious, it's just something that we're going to have to know. We're going to have to take the time if we want to have a healthy world. And a healthy world, I mean a healthy food system, vibrant farm economies, and healthy rural environments where people who are farming and who are living in the country, you know, actually depend on a sane environment to live their lives.
Well, some really good writers are speaking out about this. Tell us about some of the authors in these CAFO books.
Well, I read dozens and dozens of books when the assignment first came to my desk. And really, since 2000, there have been so many great books that either are focused on this topic or are partially focused on this topic. And so I had a wide range of voices to choose from. I didn't want it to be seen as a vegan or slow food or, you know, simply a sustainable agriculture lens which we're looking at the issue through. So there are 30 different voices in the big book. They include farmers, ranchers, chefs. One author, Matthew Scully, is a former speechwriter for a Republican president, George W. Bush. then we have really prominent writers who've been writing about food and agriculture for a long time, like Wendell Berry and Michael Pollan. But then we have research organizations, the Center for a Livable Future in the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and also fellows who participated in the Pew Commission report on industrial animal agriculture. So, I mean, you've got this wide, wide range of voices reporting.
How big are concentrated animal feeding operations?
Well, they're big. They're huge. They produce obscene amounts of waste, and they're getting bigger. It's not uncommon for a cattle feedlot to hold 100,000 cattle at any one time. These broiler sheds, these windowless barns where they grow meat chickens, hold 20 to 30,000 chickens. You can have 80,000 hens or more in a single building, 1,000 full-grown pigs, hogs, in a hog barn where, you know, these animals are not being exposed to the open air, scratching in the dirt, and really living the kind of life that they're used to. The modus operandi of a CAFO, of a concentrated animal feeding operation, is pretty simple. You concentrate as many animals as you can in the smallest area possible, and you feed them a diet that makes them gain weight as quickly as possible for the least amount of cost. And oftentimes what you have is just a life that is short and miserable and nowhere near the life that particular species was born to lead.
This is Radio EcoShock talking with Daniel Imhoff, editor of two new books on industrial animal factories. Daniel, start us through the food chain. What are the ecological risks involved with getting the feed for all these animals to fatten them up?
It is sometimes brought up that we have so few farmers today so that we're all freed up to, we other citizens are freed up to do other things in the economy. But what we have is farmers producing vast amounts of feed to fatten animals in confinement. The key driver of that industrial grain is corn and soy and hay. And among them, those big three, they occupy hundreds of millions of acres of the American landscape, particularly corn and soy. Their yields are maximized with heavy applications of fertilizers. And oftentimes they're cultivated with herbicides, pesticides. Their cultivation is dependent upon water. And in cultivation, we also have some pretty severe and continuous impacts on the soil. We're losing a lot of our best soil. We have a feeding system that is highly industrialized. It's dependent upon fossil fuel inputs. And many argue that it's really not sustainable for the long term. So the question about how can we feed the world, I think we also have to look at how can we feed the world, especially because we're using so much of the world's resources to produce feed to then feed to animals in confinement.
And another part of that food chain, the government here runs big billboards telling people to wash their hands with common soap. Antibacterial soap, they say, is leading to antibiotic-resistant bacteria. But I don't see any big ads warning me about the load of antibiotics in meat production. How bad is that?
Well, if you talk to the researchers at Johns Hopkins Medical School, they will tell you that we're very close to squandering human antibiotic medicines, which many have proclaimed as the greatest medical discovery of the last 500 years. Antibiotics are routinely fed to animals in CAFOs, basically as a means of life support, to keep them alive in these rather gruesome conditions, especially because they're eating such a high-octane diet to put on protein as fast as possible, rather than growing more slowly in appropriate numbers in far different conditions than, you know, being stuck in cages or pens or windowless barns. And when you look at the numbers, the state of North Carolina, CAFOs in the state of North Carolina apply more antibiotic medicines on animal food production than all of human consumption of antibiotic medicines. And it's the same with the state of Iowa as well. And what you find is they're using many of the same penicillin and tetracycline antibiotics in animal production as we depend on in human production. And the real scare there is that this overdosing of antibiotics in animal factories is potentially creating these super resistant strains of diseases that could affect us, and then we're going to be powerless really to defend ourselves against them.
And despite all that, these unhealthy animals seem to be a magnet for the development of diseases like swine flu or bird flu. Is it possible our food supply could lead to the next great plague?
Certainly, that's a great fear. You know, you have whole divisions of companies, you know, pharmaceutical companies, working on cures for these flus should they arise. Of course, it's an extremely real fear.
You mentioned our pets. The Humane Society goes after people who mistreat them. Don't we have laws in North America to protect farm animals, and how do our laws compare with what's going on in Europe?
I think Europe is ahead of our laws. Ironically, when it comes to livestock, the greatest protection that they're afforded is under the Humane Slaughter Act, which says that they can't be slaughtered when they're conscious. The big loophole in the Humane Slaughter Act is that it doesn't apply to birds. And, you know, out of the 10 billion animals that are slaughtered each year in the United States for food, not including fish, 9 billion of them are meat chickens. And so our greatest by number food item is exempted from the Humane Slaughter Act. What we do find is that for many decades now, European countries have been very concerned about certain production methods, banning of extreme confinement methods, searching for better ways, looking for better ways for slaughter. And I really, truly think it's time that we, USDA, we as a society, if the federal government isn't acting, then as state governments we might act, to adopt the best practices that are really out there in the world. And then, you know, to really rely on the amazing resources that we have, that the human resources that we have addressing this issue, like, you know, Temple Grandin at Colorado State University, who she deserves a huge department of people working under her with some kind of visionary program for productive, safe, clean, affordable animal food products for the next 30 to 50 years, something truly visionary.
So we could have an agricultural system that doesn't shame intelligent beings?
I want to make very clear that our message in CAFO is definitely that we want small-scale farmers and ranchers to thrive. We don't want industrial agriculture, the real truth of industrial agriculture, to be the face of small family farmers and ranchers. But we want people to eat healthy animal food products should they choose to do that.
Dan, could you give us just a couple of tips on what we can do as consumers to help reshape that food system?
You can work on so many levels, from the very, very personal home level to schools and businesses, and then on to political, local, regional, state, national political levels. You can vote with your fork. You can really see your food purchases as this very active way that you participate in the world around you, on the land, in terms of how plants and animals are produced and how the people who raise them are treated. And I think you can also do a good deal of research in your own region, and there's great books out there. If you're not familiar with the issue, certainly the CAFO and CAFO Reader are a good start, but I think you can make your own manifesto, your own eating manifesto, about what you feel about animal products, that maybe you want to buy the best quality that you can and learn to make the most of those products and to really honor them. But then also, whenever there's an election coming up, and at whatever level, I believe that there is a very important place for all the issues related to food production to be on anyone's platform. They are just that important. If we as a country were to make a healthy food system one of our driving economic goals, I think we would have a far different economy and society and future ahead of us.
I know the big meat producers are very protective. They're well hidden from view. They've got security systems. They've got laws in the United States that define somebody coming in to take pictures as some sort of agricultural terrorism. So how did you come across these images of gigantic production and the animals suffering?
Well, that's a really good question. We started with 6,000 photographs, and in getting down to the large photo format book, we collected 450. The majority of those photographs came from, or at least the largest number, came from news agencies, from Associated Press and Reuters and photographer agencies like Corbis and newspapers, the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune, Charlotte Observer. These were photographers that were granted access. Any food journalist who wants to go visit a CAFO has a very difficult time getting in. And so we really relied on and purchased a lot of photos from photographers who were given releases to be on those premises. And then you have numerous groups around the country, dozens of groups, amazing organizations who have been fighting this expansion of CAFOs in their communities for many decades. And so, you know, there's a pretty rich body of work by those photographers as well.
Well, that's why these books have to get out, people. The CAFO Reader, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories, and the Companion Photo Book are lasting tools for activists, I think. So on behalf of millions of animals and their hidden suffering in our industrial food machine, I urge you to educate yourself and others and act to change it as you can. My thanks to Daniel Imhoff in Northern California.
Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith.
And my thanks to Alex Smith, who's sitting outside our studio here, for conducting that wonderful interview last year that he originally aired on his show, Radio EcoShock, which is coming up. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So you've been listening to Animal Voices Radio. It's 100.5 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week on the show, we'll have a feature interview with one of the rescue workers from the Humane Society of the United States, who is presently involved with the animal rescue effort in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy in the area of New Jersey.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that because it's a topic that whenever a natural disaster happens, there was the Hurricane Katrina, you remember, and of course, there was 9/11. I've always wanted to have a show where we feature a major interview about this topic on what people are doing to help those animals, what kind of help they need, and how you can prevent the worst possible situation from happening to your animals if such a thing happens. So I'm really looking forward to that next week.
And so they'll be speaking with us, we here at Animal Shows also modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also, please do check out our website, www.animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded. And if you appreciate the work that we do here every week at Animal Voices to bring you original quality programming on the topics of current animal issues and the vegan lifestyle, please show us your support by making a donation to us at Animal Voices at Co-op Radio, because we do rely on your donations to keep this show on the air. To make a donation of $5, $10, $20, or whatever you can afford, nothing's too little, simply go to www.cooperadio.org and click on Donate Now. And remember to indicate on your donation that it's going towards Animal Voices. And if you're in Canada and make a donation of at least $25, your donations are tax deductible.
And if you actually do it on our website, cooperadio.org, any amount of donation is actually tax deductible. I found that out.
All right. And in honor of all animals who die at the hands of man, whether they be in war or in concentrated animal feeding operations, we are leaving you here with the Hymn for the Fallen, composed by John Williams and performed by the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra. So stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. And thank you so much to listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.